nor Domrod the Gnome, note 2. And in the amended passage he wrote that Urin had known Beren and had rendered him a service once in respect of Domrod his son. There is no clue anywhere as to what this service may have been, but in the second of the schemes for the Book of Lost Tales, see 1, 233-4, the outline for the tale of the Nauglofring refers to the son of Beren and Tenuviel, the father of Elwing, by the name Daimord, although in the actual tale as written, the son is, as he was to remain, Dior. Presumably, Daimord is to be equated with Domrod. I cannot explain the insertion of Domrod the Gnome against Egnor in the rejected passage. Possibly it was no more than a passing idea to give the name Domrod to Beren's father. It may be noticed here that both the rejected and the replacement passages make it very clear that the events of the story of Beren and Tenuviel took place before the Battle of Unnumbered Tears. See pages 65-6. 2. The Battle of Tassarinam. It is said at the beginning of the present tale, page 70, that it tells of very ancient days of that folk, men, before the Battle of Tassarinam, when first men entered the dark vales of Hissilome. On the face of it, this offers an extreme contradiction, since it is said many times that men were shut in Hissilome at the time of the Battle of Unnumbered Tears, and the tale of Turambar takes place, must take place, after that battle. The solution lies, however, in an ambiguity in the sentence just cited. My father did not mean that this was a tale of men in ancient days of that folk before they entered Hissilome. He meant this is a tale of the ancient days when men first entered Hissilome, long before the Battle of Tassarinam. Tassarinam is the land of willows, Nan Tathrin in the Silmarillion. The early word lists or dictionaries give the Elvish form Tassarin, willow, and the Gnomish Tathrin. Footnote. Tassarinam survived as the Quenya name without change. The willow meads of Tassarinam in Treebeard's song in The Two Towers, 3-4. End of footnote. The Battle of Tassarinam took place long after, in the course of the great expedition from Valinor for the release of the enslaved Noldali in the Great Lands. See pages 219-20. 3. The Geography of the Tale of Turambar. The passage describing the route of the orcs who captured Turin, page 77, seems to give further support to the idea that the mountains fencing Hissilome from the lands beyond were continuous with those above Angband, page 62. For it is said here that the orcs followed ever the line of dark hills toward those regions where they rise high and gloomy and their heads are shrouded in black vapors. And there are they called Angorodin, or the Iron Mountains, for beneath the roots of their northernmost fastnesses lies Angband. The sight of the caves of the Rodothlim, agreeing well with what is said later of Nargothrond, has been discussed already, page 123, and has the topography of the Silver Bowl and the ravine in which Turambar slew Glorin in relation to the later Teglin, Celebros, and Nengirith, pages 132-3. There are, in addition, some indications in the tale of how the caves of the Rodothlim related to Tinguelin's kingdom and to the land where the woodmen dwelt. It is said, page 95, that the dwellings of the Rodothlim were not utterly distant from the realm of Tinguelin, albeit far enough. While the woodmen dwelt in lands that were not utterly far from Sirion or the grassy hills of that river's middle course, page 91, which may be taken to agree tolerably with the situation of the forest of Brethil. The region where they lived is said in the same passage to have been very far away many a journey beyond the river of the Rodothlim. And Glorin's wrath was great when he heard of a brave folk of men that dwelt far beyond the river, page 103. This also can be accommodated quite well to the developed geographical conception. Brethil was indeed a good distance beyond the river, Narog, for one setting out from Nargothrond. My strong impression is that though the geography of the west of the great lands may have been still fairly vague, it already had in many important respects the same essential structure and relations as those seen on the map accompanying the Silmarillion. 4. The influence of the Valar. As in the tale of Tenuvial, see page 68, in the tale of Turambar also there are several references to the power of the Valar in the affairs of men and elves in the great lands, and to prayers both of thanksgiving and request addressed to them. Thus Turin's guardians thanked the Valar that they accomplished the journey to Artanor, page 72, and more remarkably, Urin called upon the Valar of the West, being taught much concerning them by the Eldar of Kor, the gnomes he had encountered. And his words came, who shall say how, to Manwë Sulemo upon the heights of Taniketil, page 77. Urin was already an elf friend instructed by the Noldali. Compare the replacement passage on page 72. Was his prayer answered? Possibly this is the meaning of the very strange expression, as the luck of the Valar had it, page 79, when Flinding and Beleg found Turin lying near the point where they entered the orc camp. Footnote. The Gnomish dictionary has the entry, Gwalt, good luck, any providential occurrence or thought, the luck of the Valar, I Walt ne Vanyon, 1272. End of footnote. Dreams sent by the Valar came to the chieftains of the Rodothlin, though this was changed later and the reference to the Valar removed, page 83 and note 10. The woodman said, would that the Valar would lift the spell that lies upon Ninyo, page 101. And Turin cried out bitterly against the Valar and his fate of woe, page 111. An interesting reference to the Valar and their power occurs in Tinwellen's reply, page 95, to Morwen's words, give me but a woodman's cot and my son. The king said, that I cannot, for I am but a king of the wild elves, and no Valar of the Western Isles. In the small part of Gilfanan's tale that was actually written, it is told, 1.231, of the dark elves who remained in Polisor, that they said that their brethren had gone westward to the Shining Isles. There, said they, do the gods dwell. And they called them the Great Folk of the West, and thought they dwelt on firelit islands in the sea. 5. Turin's age. According to the tale of Turambar, when Turin left Morwen, he was 7 years old, and it was after he had dwelt among the woodland elves for 7 years that all tidings from his home ceased, page 74. In the Narn, the corresponding years are 8 and 9, and Turin was 17, not 14, when his grief was renewed, pages 68, 76-7. It was exactly 12 years to the day of his departure from Morwen, when he slew Orgoth and fled from Artanor, page 75, when he was 19. In the Narn, page 79, it was likewise 12 years since he left Hithlum when he hunted Syros to his death, but he was 20. The tale tells not the number of days that Turambar sojourned with the Rodothlim, but these were very many, and during that time the Anori grew to the threshold of womanhood, pages 91-2. The Anori was 7 years younger than Turin. She was 12 when he fled from Artanor, Ibid. He cannot then have dwelt among the Rodothlim for more than, say, 5 or 6 years. And it is said that when he was chosen chieftain of the woodmen, he possessed wisdom great beyond his years. Bethos, chieftain of the woodsmen before Turin, had fought, though then but a boy, in the Battle of Unnumbered Tears, page 101. But he was killed in a foray, since, despite his years, he still rode abroad. But it is impossible to relate Bethos' span from a boy at the Battle of Unnumbered Tears to his death on a foray at an age sufficiently ripe to be remarked on to Turin's. For the events after the destruction of the Rodothlin, culminating in Turin's rescue of Ninyul after her first encounter with Glorum, cannot cover any great length of time. What is clear and certain is that in the old story, Turin died when still a very young man. According to the precise dating provided in much later writing, he was 35 years old at his death. 6. The stature of elves and men. The elves are conceived to be of slighter build and stature than men. So Beleg was of great stature and girth, as such was among that folk, page 73. And Turin was a man and of greater stature than they. That is, Beleg and Flinding, page 80. This sentence being an emendation from, he was a man of great size, note 8. See on this matter 1.32-235. 7. Winged Dragons. At the end of the Silmarillion, page 252, Morgoth loosed upon his foes the last desperate assault that he had prepared. And out of the pits of Ungband there issued the winged dragons that had not before been seen. The suggestion is that winged dragons were a refinement of Morgoth's original design, embodied in Glaurung, father of dragons who went upon his belly. According to the tale of Turambar, pages 96 to 7, on the other hand, among Melkor's many dragons, some were smaller, cold, like snakes, and of these many were flying creatures. While others, the mightier, were hot and heavy, fire dragons, and these were unwinged. As already noted, page 125, there is no suggestion in the tale that Glorund was the first of his kind. 3. The Fall of Gondolin. At the end of Eltar's account of Urin's visit to Tinwelland and of the strange fates of Urin and Mavwin, Turin and Nienore, page 116, the manuscript written on loose sheets, in fact, continues with a brief interlude in which the further course of the tale-telling is discussed in Marvanwa Hjalieva. And so saying, Eltas made an end, and none asked further. But Lindo bid all thank him for his tale, and thereto he said, "Nay, if you will, there is much yet to tell concerning the gold of Glorund, and how the evil of that worm found its last fulfillment. But behold, that is the story of the Naglofring, or the necklace of the dwarves, and must wait a while. And other stories of lighter and more happy things I have to tell, if you would liefer listen to them." Then arose many voices begging Eltas to tell the tale of the Naglofring on the morrow, but he said, "Nay, for who here knows the full tale of Tuor on the coming of Eärendil? Or who was Beren el Mabwed, and what were his deeds? For such things is it better to know rightly first." And all said that Beren el Mabwed they knew well, but of the coming of Eärendil little enough had ever been told. "And great harm is that," said Lindo, "for it is the greatest of the stories of the gnomes. And even in this house is Ilfiniol, son of Bronwyg, who knows those deeds more truly than any that are now on earth." About that time, Ilfiniol, the gong warden, entered indeed. And Lindo said to him, "Behold, O little heart, son of Bronwyg, it is the desire of all that you tell us the tales of Tuor and of Eärendil as soon as may be." And Ilfiniol was fain of that, but said he, "It is a mighty tale, and 7 times shall folk fare to the tale-fire ere it be rightly told. And so twined is it with those stories of the Naglofring and of the Elf-march, that I would fain have aid in that telling of Ailios here, and of Meryl, the Lady of the Isle, for long is it since she sought this house." Note 1. Elf-march. Not, of course, the great journey to the sea from the waters of awakening, but the expedition of the elves of Kor for the rescue of the gnomes. See 1:26. End of note. "Therefore were messengers sent on the next day to the Corin of High Elms, and they said that Lindo and Vaera would fain see the face of their lady among them, for they purposed to make a festival and to hold a great telling of elfin tales. Ariol, their guest, fared a while to Thavrovo." Note 2. A Corin is defined in The Cottage of Lost Play, 1:16, as a great circular hedge, be it of stone or of thorn or even of trees, that encloses a green sword. "Meryl y Turinki dwelt in a great Corin of elms." End of note. So was it that for 3 days that room heard no more tales, and the folk of Vanwa Tjallieva made great preparations. But on the 4th night Meryl fared there amid her company of maidens, and full of light and mirth was that place. But after the evening meet, a great host sat before Tornar Gwedrin. Note 3, Tornar Gwedrin is the tale fire, end of note. "And the maidens of Meryl sang the most beautiful songs that island knew." Note 4, there is here a direction, "See hereafter the Naglofring," but this is struck out. End of note. "And of those one did afterward Heorenda turn to the language of his folk, and it is thus." Note 5, on Heorenda, see pages 290 and following, 3:23. A small space is left after the words "it is thus" to mark the place of the poem in Old English that was to be inserted, but there is no indication of what it was to be. End of note. But when those songs had fallen into silence, then said Meryl, who sate in the chair of Lindo, "Come now, O Ilfinion, begin thou the tale of tales, and tell it more fully than thou hast ever done." Then said Little Heart, son of Bronwyg, "Tale of Gondolin," in parenthesis, sick. This, then, is the link between the tale of Turambar and the fall of Gondolin. An earlier preface to the tale is given below. It seems that my father hesitated as to which tale was to follow Turambar, see note 4, but decided that it was time to introduce the fall of Gondolin, which had been in existence for some time. In this link, Ailios, later Gilfonon, is present. I would fain have aid of Ailios here. At the end of Eltar's tale of Turambar, but at the beginning of Eltar's tale, page 70, it is expressly said that he was not present that night. On the proposal that Eriol should fare a while to Tovrobol as the guest of Gilfonon, see 1.175. The fact that Eltas speaks of the tale of Beren Ermabwed as if he did not know that it had only recently been told in Marvanwa Tjallieva is no doubt to be explained by that tale not having been told before the tale fire, see pages 4-7. The teller of the tale of the fall of Gondolin, Little Heart the Gong Warden of Marvanwa Tjallieva, has appeared several times in the Lost Tales, and his elvish names, have many different forms. See under Changes Made to Names at the end of the text of the tale. In The Cottage of Lost Play, he is said, 1:15, to be ancient beyond count, and to have sailed in Wingelot with Earendel in that last voyage wherein they sought for Kor. And in The Link to the Music of the Ainur, 1:46, he had a weather-worn face and blue eyes of great merriment, and was very slender and small, or might one say if he were 50 or 10,000. He is a gnome, the son of Bronwyg, Voronwë of the Silmarillion, 1:48-94. The Texts of the Fall of Gondolin. The textual history of the fall of Gondolin, if considered in detail, is extremely complex. But though I will set it out here as I understand it, there is no need, in fact, for it to complicate the reading of the tale. In the first place, there is a very difficult manuscript contained in 2 school exercise books, where the title of the tale is T'war and the Exiles of Gondolin, which bringeth in the great tale of Earendel. This is the only title actually found in the early texts, but my father always later referred to it as The Fall of Gondolin. This manuscript is, or rather was, the original text of the tale, dating from 1916-17, see 1203, and Unfinished Tales, page 4. And I will call it here for convenience, T'war A. My father's treatment of it subsequently was unlike that of Tinuviel and Turambar, where the original text was erased and a new version written in its place. In this tale, he did not set down a complete new text, but allowed a good deal of the old to stand, at least in the earlier part of it. As the revision progressed, the rewriting in ink over the top of the penciled text did become almost continuous, and though the pencil was not erased, the ink effectively obliterates it. But even after the second version becomes continuous, there are several places where the old narrative was not overwritten, but merely struck through and remains legible. Thus, while T'war A is on the same footing as Tinuviel and Turambar and others of the Lost Tales, in that it is a later revision, a second version, my father's method in Gondolin, allows it to be seen that here at least the revision was by no means a complete recasting, still less a reimagining. For if those passages in the later parts of the tale, which can still be compared in the 2 versions, show that he was following the old fairly closely, the same is quite probably true in those places where no comparison can be made. From T'war A, as it was when all changes had been made to it, that is, when it was in the form that it has now, my mother made a fair copy, T'war B, which, considering the difficulty of the original, is extremely exact, with only very occasional errors of transcription. I have said in Unfinished Tales, page 5, that this copy was made apparently in 1917, but this now seems to me improbable. Footnote. Humphrey Carpenter, in his biography, page 92, says that the tale was written out during Tolkien's convalescence at Great Heywood early in 1917. But he is doubtless referring to the original penciled text of Tuor A. End of footnote. Such conceptions as the music of the Ainur, which is referred to by later edition in Tuor A, page 163, may, of course, have been in my father's mind a good while before he wrote that tale in Oxford while working on the dictionary, 145. But it seems more likely that the revision of Tuor A, and therefore also Tuor B, copied from it after its revision, belongs to that period also. Subsequently, my father took his pencil to Tuor B, emending it fairly heavily, though mostly in the earlier part of the tale, and almost entirely for stylistic rather than narrative reasons. But these emendations, as will be seen, were not all made at the same time. Some of them are written out on separate slips, and of these, several have on their reverse sides parts of an etymological discussion of certain Germanic words for the butcher bird or shrike. Material which appears in the Oxford Dictionary in the entry Warriangle. Taken with the fact that one of the slips with this material on the reverse clearly contains a direction for the shortening of the tale when delivered orally, see note 21, it is virtually certain that a good deal of the revision of Tuor B was made before my father read it to the Essay Club of Exeter College in the spring of 1920, see Unfinished Tales, page 5. That not all the emendations to Tuor B were made at the same time is shown by the existence of a typescript, Tuor C, without title, which extends only so far as Your Hill of Vigilance Against the Evil of Melko, page 161. This was taken from Tuor B, when some changes had been made to it, but not those which I deduced to have been made before the occasion when it was read aloud. An odd feature of this text is that blanks were left for many of the names, and only some were filled in afterwards. Towards the end of it, there is a good deal of independent variation from Tuor B, but it is all of a minor character, and none has narrative significance. I conclude that this was a side branch that petered out. The textual history can then be represented thus. Tuor A, original 1916-17 text in pencil. Then, heavily revised and in the later parts entirely overwritten. Then Tuor B, fair copy. Then minor stylistic revisions and changes to names. Tuor C, typescript, does not extend far, minor stylistic changes. Further alterations mainly on inserted slips and further changes to names before reading it at Exeter College in 1920, the text in this book. Since the narrative itself underwent very little change of note in the course of this history, granted that substantial parts of the original text Tuor A are almost entirely illegible, the text that follows here is that of Tuor B in its final form, with some interesting earlier readings given in the notes. It seems that my father did not check the fair copy Tuor B against the original, and did not in every case pick up the errors of transcription it contains. When he did, he emended them anew, according to the sense, and not by reference back to Tuor A. In a very few cases, I have gone back to Tuor A, where this is clearly correct. As a wall of water rose nigh to the cliff top, page 151, where Tuor B and the typescript Tuor C have high to the cliff top. Throughout the typescript, Tuor is called Tuor. In Tuor B, the name is sometimes emended from Tuor to Tuor in the earlier part of the tale. It appears as Tuor in the latest revisions, but by no means in every case. My father apparently decided to change the name, but ultimately decided against it, and I give Tuor throughout. An interesting document accompanies the tale. This is a substantial, though incomplete, list of names with explanations that occur in it, now in places difficult or impossible to read. The names are given in alphabetical order, but go only as far as L. Linguistic information from this list is incorporated in the appendix on names, but the headnote to the list may be cited here. Here is set forth by Ariel at the teaching of Bronwegg's son Elfrith, emended from Elfriniel, or Little Heart, and he was so named for the youth and wonder of his heart. Those names and words that are used in these tales from either the tongue of the elves of Kor, as at that time spoken in the Lonely Isle, or from that related one of the Noldali, their kin, whom they wrested from Melko. Here first are they which appear in the tale of Tuor and the exiles of Gondolin, first among these those ones in the gnome speech. In Tuor A appear two versions, one struck out, of a short preface to the tale by Littleheart, which does not appear in Tuor B. The second version reads, "Then said Littleheart, son of Bronwegg, now the story that I tell is of the Noldali, who were my father's folk, and belike the names will ring strange in your ears, and familiar folk be called by names not before heard. For the Noldali speak a curious tongue, sweet still to my ears, though not maybe to all the Eldar. Wise folk see it as close kin to Eldarissa, but it soundeth not so, and I know naught of such lore. Wherefore will I utter to you the right Eldar names, where there be such, but in many cases there be none. Know then," said he, "that..." The earlier version, headed Link Between Tuor and Tale Before, begins in the same way, but then diverges. "And it is sweet to my ears still, though lest it be not so to all else of Eldar and men here gathered, I will use no more of it than I must. And that is in the names of those folk and things whereof the tale tells, but for which, seeing they passed away ere ever the rest of the Eldar came from Kor, the elves have no true names. Know then," said he, "that Tuor..." This preface thus connects to the opening of the tale. There here appears in the second version the name Eldarissa for the language of the Eldar or elves, as opposed to Noldarissa, a term found in the name list. On the distinction involved, see 1:50-51. With Littleheart's words, here compare what Rumil said to Eriol about him. 1:48. "Tongues and speeches," they will say, "one is enough for me." And thus said Littleheart, the gong warden, once upon a time, "Gnome speech," said he, "is enough for me. Did not that one Earendel, and Tuor, and Bronwegg my father, that mincingly ye miscall the Ronwe, speak it and no other? Yet he had to learn the elfin in the end, or be doomed either to silence or to leave Marvanwa Tialieva." End of side 5. To continue, turn the cassette over. Side 6. The Book of Lost Tales, Part 2, by J.R.R. Tolkien. Continuing on page 149. After these lengthy preliminaries, I give the text of the tale. Tuor and the Exiles of Gondolin, which bringeth in the great tale of Earendel. Then said Littleheart, son of Bronwegg, "Know then that Tuor was a man who dwelt in very ancient days in that land of the north called Dor Lomin, or the Land of Shadows, and of the Eldar the Noldali know it best. Now the folk whence Tuor came wandered the forests and fells and knew not and sang not of the sea. For Tuor dwelt not with them, and lived alone about that lake called Mithrim, now hunting in its woods, now making music beside its shores on his rugged harp of wood and the sinews of bears. Now many hearing of the power of his rough songs came from near and far to hearken to his harping. But Tuor left his singing and departed to lonely places. Here he learnt many strange things and got knowledge of the wandering Noldali, who taught him much of their speech and lore. But he was not fated to dwell forever in those woods. Thereafter 'tis said that magic and destiny led him on a day to a cavernous opening down which a hidden river flowed from Mithrim. And Tuor entered that cavern seeking to learn its secret. But the waters of Mithrim drove him forward into the heart of the rock, and he might not win back into the light. And this, 'tis said, was the will of Ulmo, Lord of Waters, at whose prompting the Noldali had made that hidden way. Then came the Noldali to Tuor, and guided him along dark passages amid the mountains, until he came out in the light once more, and saw that the river flowed swiftly in a ravine of great depth with sides unscalable. Now Tuor desired no more to return, but went ever forward, and the river led him always toward the west. Note 6. This passage, beginning with the words, "And Tuor entered that cavern," on page 149, is a late replacement written on a slip, see page 147. The original passage was largely similar in meaning, but contained the following. Now in delving that riverway beneath the hills, the Naugerly worked unknown to Melko, who in those deep days held them yet hidden and thralls beneath his will. Rather were they prompted by Ulmo, who strove ever against Melko, and through Tuor he hoped to devise for the gnomes release from the terror of the evil of Melko. End of note. The sun rose behind his back and set before his face, and where the water foamed among many boulders or fell over falls, there were at times rainbows woven across the ravine. But at evening its smooth sides would glow in the setting sun, and for these reasons Tuor called it Golden Cleft, or the Gully of the Rainbow Roof, which is, in the speech of the gnomes, Glorfalk, or Chris Ilbrantelof. Now Tuor journeyed here for 3 days, drinking the waters of the secret river and feeding on its fish, and these were of gold and blue and silver and of many wondrous shapes. Note 7, 3 days, 3 years, all texts. But days, question mark, penciled above years in Tuor B, end of note. At length the ravine widened, and ever as it opened its sides became lower and more rough, and the bed of the river more impeded with boulders against which the waters foamed and spouted. Long times would Tuor sit and gaze at the splashing water and listen to its voice, and then he would rise and leap onward from stone to stone, singing as he went, or as the stars came out on the narrow strip of heaven above the gully, he would raise echoes to answer the fierce twanging of his harp. One day, after a great journey of weary going, Tuor at deep evening heard a cry, and he might not decide of what creature it came. Now he said, it is a fey creature. Now, nay, 'tis but some small beast that waileth among the rocks. Or again it seemed to him that an unknown bird piped with a voice new to his ears and strangely sad. And because he had not heard the voice of any bird in all his wandering down Golden Cleft, he was glad of the sound, although it was mournful. On the next day, at an hour of the morning, he heard the same cry above his head, and looking up beheld 3 great white birds beating back up the gully on strong wing, and uttering cries like to the ones he had heard amid the dusk. Now these were the gulls, the birds of Osse. Note 8. The evolution of seabirds through Osse is described in the tale of the Cunning of the Elves, 1-123. But the sentence here derives from the original penciled text of Tuor A, end of note. In this part of that riverway there were islets of rock amid the currents, and fallen rocks fringed with white sand at the gully side, so that it was ill going. And seeking a while, Tuor found the spot where he might with labor scale the cliffs at last. Then came a fresh wind against his face, and he said, this is very good, and like the drinking of wine. But he knew not that he was near the confines of the great sea. As he went along above the waters, that ravine again drew together, and the walls towered up, so that he fared on a high cliff top, and there came a narrow neck, and this was full of noise. Then Tuor, looking downward, saw the greatest of marvels, for it seemed that a flood of angry water would come up the narrows and flow back against the river to its source. But that water which had come down from distant Mithrim would still press on, and a wall of water rose nigh to the clifftop, and it was crowned with foam and twisted by the winds. Then the waters of Mithrim were overthrown, and the incoming flood swept roaring up the channel and whelmed the rocky islets and churned the white sand, so that Tuor fled and was afraid, who did not know the ways of the sea. But the Ainur put it into his heart to climb from the gully when he did, or had he been whelmed in the incoming tide, and that was a fierce one by reason of a wind from the west. Then Tuor found himself in a rugged country, bare of trees, and swept by a wind coming from the set of the sun, and all the shrubs and bushes leaned to the dawn because of that prevalence of that wind. And here for a while he wandered till he came to the black cliffs by the sea, and saw the ocean and its waves for the first time. And at that hour the sun sank beyond the rim of earth far out to sea, and he stood on the cliff-top with outspread arms, and his heart was filled with a longing very great indeed. Now some say that he was the first of men to reach the sea, and look upon it, and know the desire it brings, but I know not if they say well. In those regions he set up his abode, dwelling in a cove sheltered by great sable rocks, whose floor was of white sand, save when the high flood partly overspread it with blue water. Nor did foam or froth come there, save at times of the direst tempest. There long he sojourned alone, and roamed about the shore, or fared over the rocks at the ebb, marveling at the pools and the great weeds, the dripping caverns, and the strange sea-fowl that he saw and came to know. But the rise and fall of the water and the voice of the waves was ever to him the greatest wonder, and ever did it seem a new and unimaginable thing. Now on the quiet waters of Mithrim, over which the voice of the duck or moor-hen would carry far, he had fared much in a small boat with a prow fashioned like to the neck of a swan, and this he had lost on the day of his finding the hidden river. On the sea he had ventured not as yet, though his heart was ever egging him with a strange longing thereto. And on quiet evenings, when the sun went down beyond the edge of the sea, it grew to a fierce desire. Timber he had that came down the hidden river. A goodly wood it was, for the Naldali hewed it in the forests of Dor Lomin, and floated it to him of a purpose. But he built not as yet aught save a dwelling in a sheltered place of his cove, which tales among the Eldar since name Falasquil. This by slow labor he adorned with fair carvings of the beasts and trees and flowers and birds that he knew about the waters of Mithrim, and ever among them was the swan, the chief, for Tuor loved this emblem, and it became the sign of himself, his kindred and folk thereafter. There he passed a very great while, until the loneliness of the empty sea got into his heart, and even Tuor the solitary longed for the voice of men. Herewith the Ainur had something to do, for Ulmo loved Tuor. Note 9. In the typescript Tuor C, a blank was left here, see page 147, and subsequently filled in with Ulmo, not Ainur. End of note. One morning, while casting his eye along the shore, and it was then the latest days of summer, Tuor saw three swans flying high and strong from the northward. Now these birds he had not before seen in these regions, and he took them for a sign, and said, "Long has my heart been set on a journey far from here. Lo, now at length I will follow these swans." Behold, the swans dropped into the water of his cove, and there, swimming thrice about, rose again and winged slowly south along the coast, and Tuor, bearing his harp and spear, followed them. It was a great day's journey Tuor put behind him that day, and he came ere evening to a region where trees again appeared, and the manner of the land through which he now fared differed greatly from those shores about Falasquil. There had Tuor known mighty cliffs beset with caverns and great spout-holes and deep-walled coves, but from the cliff-tops a rugged land and flat ran bleakly back to where a blue rim far to the east spake of distant hills. Now, however, did he see a long and sloping shore and stretches of sand, while the distant hills marched ever nearer to the margin of the sea, and their dark slopes were clad with pine or fir, and about their feet sprang birches and ancient oaks. From the feet of the hills fresh torrents rushed down narrow chasms, and so found the shores and the salt waves. Now some of these clefts Tuor might not overleap, and often was it ill-going in these places, but still he labored on, for the swans fared ever before him, now circling suddenly, now speeding forward, but never coming to earth, and the rush of their strong beating wings encouraged him. It is told that in this manner Tuor fared onward for a great number of days, and that winter marched from the north somewhat speedier than he, for all his tirelessness. Nevertheless came he without scathe of beast or weather at a time of first spring to a river mouth. Now here was the land less northerly and more kindly than about the issuing of the Golden Cleft, and moreover by a trend of the coast was the sea now rather to the south of him than to the west, as he could mark by the sun and stars. But he had kept his right hand always to the sea. This river flowed down a goodly channel, and on its banks were rich lands, grasses and moist meadow to the one side, and tree-grown slopes of the other. Its waters met the sea sluggishly, and fought not as the waters of Mithrim in the north. Long tongues of land lay islanded in its course, covered with reeds and bushy thicket, until further to seaward sandy spits ran out. And these were places beloved by such a multitude of birds as Tuor had nowhere yet encountered. Their piping and wailing and whistling filled the air, and here amid their white wings Tuor lost sight of the three swans, nor saw he them again. Then did Tuor grow for a season weary of the sea, for the buffeting of his travel had been sore. Nor was this without Ulmo's devising, and that night the Nordali came to him, and he arose from sleep. Guided by their blue lanterns, he found a way beside the river border, and strode so mightily inland that when dawn filled the sky to his right hand, lo, the sea and its voice were far behind him, and the wind came from before him, so that its odor was not even in the air. Thus came he soon to that region that has been called Arliscion, the place of reeds. And this is in those lands that are to the south of Dor Lomien, and separated therefrom by the iron mountains whose spurs run even to the sea. From those mountains came this river, and of a great clearness and marvelous chill were its waters even at this place. Now this is a river most famous in the histories of Eldar and Noldali, and in all tongues is it named Sirion. Here Tuor rested a while until, driven by desire, he arose once more to journey further and further by many days' marches along the river borders. Full spring had not yet brought summer when he came to a region yet more lovely. Here the song of small birds shrilled about him with a music of loveliness, for there are no birds that sing like the songbirds of the land of willows. And to this region of wonder he had now come. Here the river wound in wide curves with low banks through a great plain of the sweetest grass and very long and green. Willows of untold age were about its borders, and its wide bosom was strewn with water lily leaves, whose flowers were not yet in the earliness of the year, but beneath the willows the green swords of the flag lilies were drawn, and sedges stood and reeds in embattled array. Now there dwelt in these dark places a spirit of whispers, and it whispered to Tuor at dusk, and he was loath to depart. And at morn, for the glory of the unnumbered buttercups, he was yet more loath, and he tarried. Here saw he the first butterflies, and was glad of the sight. And it is said that all butterflies and their kindred were born in the valley of the land of willows. Then came the summer, and the time of moths, and the warm evenings. And Tuor wondered at the multitude of flies, at their buzzing, and the droning of the beetles, and the hum of bees. And to all these things he gave names of his own, and wove the names into new songs on his old harp. And these songs were softer than his singing of old. Then Ulmo grew in dread lest Tuor dwell forever here, and the great things of his design come not to fulfillment. Therefore he feared longer to trust Tuor's guidance to the Noldali alone, who did service to him in secret, and out of fear of Melko wavered much. Nor were they strong against the magic of that place of willows, for very great was its enchantment. Did not even after the days of Tuor Noldorin and his Eldar come there seeking for Dor Lomien and the hidden river and the caverns of the gnomes' imprisonment? Yet thus nigh to their quest's end were like to abandon it. Indeed, sleeping and dancing here, and making fair music of river sounds and the murmur of grass, and weaving rich fabrics of gossamer and the feathers of winged insects, they were whelmed by the goblins sped by Melko from the hills of iron, and Noldorin made their escape thence. But these things were not as yet. Behold now, Ulmo leapt upon his car before the doorway of his palace below the still waters of the outer sea. And his car was drawn by narwhal and sea lion, and was in fashion like a whale. And amidst the sounding of great conches he sped from Ulmanon. So great was the speed of his going that in days, and not in years without count as might be thought, he reached the mouth of the river. Up this his car might not fare without hurt to its water and its banks. Therefore Ulmo, loving all rivers, and this one more than most, went thence on foot, robed to the middle in mail, like the scales of blue and silver fishes. But his hair was a bluish silver, and his beard to his feet was of the same hue, and he bore neither helm nor crown. Beneath his mail fell the skirts of his kirtle of shimmering greens, and of what substance these were woven is not known, but whoso looked into the depths of their subtle colors seemed to behold the faint movements of deep waters shot with the stealthy lights of phosphorescent fish that live in the abyss. Girt was he with a rope of mighty pearls, and he was shod with mighty shoes of stone. Thither he bore, too, his great instrument of music. And this was of strange design, for it was made of many long twisted shells pierced with holes. Blowing therein and playing with his long fingers, he made deep melodies of a magic greater than any other among musicians have ever compassed on harp or lute, or lyre or pipe, or instruments of the bow. Then coming along the river, he sate among the reeds at twilight, and played upon his thing of shells. And it was nigh to those places where Tuor tarried. And Tuor hearkened, and was stricken dumb. There he stood, knee-deep in the grass, and heard no more the hum of insects, nor the murmur of the river borders, and the odor of flowers entered not into his nostrils. But he heard the sound of waves, and the wail of sea-birds, and his soul leapt for rocky places and the ledges that reek of fish, for the splash of the diving cormorant, and those places where the sea bores into the black cliffs and yells aloud. Then Ulmo arose and spake to him, and for dread he came near to death, for the depth of the voice of Ulmo is of the uttermost depth, even as deep as his eyes, which are the deepest of all things. And Ulmo said, O Tuor of the lonely heart, I will not that thou dwell forever in fair places of birds and flowers, nor would I lead thee through this pleasant land, but that so it must be. Note 10. The original reading was, Thou Tuor of the lonely heart, the Valar will not to dwell forever in fair places of birds and flowers, nor would they lead thee through this pleasant land. End of note. But fare now on thy destined journey, and tarry not, for far from hence is thy weird set. Now must thou seek through the lands for the city of the folk called Gondothlim, or the dwellers in stone, and the Naldali shall escort thee thither in secret for fear of the spies of Melko. Words I will set to your mouth there, and there you shall abide a while. Yet maybe thy life shall turn again to the mighty waters. And of a surety a child shall come of thee, than whom no man shall know more of the uttermost deeps, be it of the sea or of the firmament of heaven. Then spake Ulmo also to Tuor some of his design and desire, but thereof Tuor understood little at that time, and feared greatly. Then Ulmo was wrapped in a mist, as it were of sea air in those inland places, and Tuor, with that music in his ears, would fain return to the regions of the great sea. Yet remembering his bidding, turned and went inland along the river, and so fared till day. Yet he that has heard the conches of Ulmo hears them call him till death, and so did Tuor find. When day came he was weary and slept till it was nigh dusk again, and the Naldali came to him and guided him. So fared he many days by dusk and dark, and slept by day, and because of this it came afterward that he remembered not over well the paths that he traversed in those times. Now Tuor and his guides held on untiring, and the land became one of rolling hills, and the river wound about their feet, and there were many dales of exceeding pleasantness. But here the Naldali became ill at ease. These, said they, are the confines of those regions which Melko infesteth with his goblins, the people of hate. Far to the north, yet alas, not far enough, would they were 10,000 leagues, lie the mountains of iron, where sits the power and terror of Melko, whose thralls we are. Indeed, in this guiding of thee we do in secret from him, and did he know all our purposes, the torment of the Balrogs would be ours. Falling then into such fear, the Naldali soon after left him, and he fared alone amid the hills, and their going proved ill afterwards, for Melko has many eyes, 'tis said. And while Tuor fared with the gnomes, they took him twilight ways, and by many secret tunnels through the hills. But now he became lost, and climbed often to the tops of knolls and hills, scanning the lands about. Yet he might not see signs of any dwelling of folk, and indeed the city of the Gondothlim was not found with ease, seeing that Melko and his spies had not even yet discovered it. It is said, nonetheless, that at this time those spies got wind thus, that the strange foot of man had been set in those lands, and that for that Melko doubled his craft and watchfulness. Now when the gnomes out of fear deserted to war, one Varonwe, or Bronweg, followed afar off, despite his fear, when chiding availed not to enhearten the others. Now Tuor had fallen into a great weariness, and was sitting beside the rushing stream, and the sea longing was about his heart, and he was minded once more to follow this river back to the wide waters and the roaring waves. But this Varonwe the faithful came up with him again, and standing by his ear said, O Tuor, think not but that thou shalt again one day see thy desire. Arise now, and behold, I will not leave thee. I am not of the road learned of the Nordeli, being a craftsman and maker of things made by hand of wood and of metal, and I joined not the band of escort till late. Yet of old have I heard whispers and sayings said in secret amid the weariness of thraldom concerning a city where Nordeli might be free could they find the hidden way thereto, and we twain may without a doubt find the road to the city of stone where is that freedom of the Gondothlim. Note 11. Without a doubt, Tuor C adds here, with Ulmo's aid. End of note. Know then that the Gondothlim were that kin of the Nordeli who alone escaped Melko's power when at the Battle of Unnumbered Tears he slew and enslaved their folk and wove spells about them and caused them to dwell in the hells of iron, faring thence at his will and bidding only. Note 12. The reference to the Battle of Unnumbered Tears is a later addition to Tuor B. The original reading was, Who alone escaped Melko's power when he caught their folk? End of note. Long time did Tuor and Bronweg seek for the city of that folk, until after many days they came upon a deep dale amid the hills. Note 13. In Tuor A and B, Varonwe is used throughout. But this phrase, with the form Bronweg, is an addition to Tuor B, replacing the original, Now after many days these twain found a deep dale. End of note. Here went the river over a very stony bed with much rush and noise, and it was curtained with a heavy growth of alders. But the walls of the dale were sheer, for they were nigh to some mountains which Varonwe knew not. There in the green wall that gnome found an opening like a great door with sloping sides, and this was cloaked with thick bushes and long tangled undergrowth. Yet Varonwe's piercing sight might not be deceived. Nonetheless, it is said that such a magic had its builders set about it by aid of Ulmo, whose power ran in that river even if the dread of Melko fared upon its banks, that none save of the blood of the Nordeli might light on it thus by chance. Nor would Tuor have found it ever but for the steadfastness of that gnome Varonwe. Note 14. The typescript Tuor C has here, that none were they not of the blood of the Nordeli might light on it, neither by chance nor age-long search. Thus was it secure from all ill hap, save treachery alone, and never would Tuor have won thereto but for the steadfastness of that gnome Varonwe. In the next sentence, Tuor C has, yet even so, no few of the bolder of the gnomes enthralled would slip down the river Sirion from the fell mountains. End of note. Now the Gondothlim made their abode thus secret out of dread of Melko. Yet even so, no few of the braver Nordeli would slip down the river Sirion from those mountains. And if many perished so by Melko's evil, many finding this magic passage came at last to the city of stone and swelled its people. Greatly did Tuor and Varonwe rejoice to find this gate. Yet entering they found there a way dark, rough-going, and circuitous. And long time they travelled, faltering within its tunnels. It was full of fearsome echoes, and there a countless stepping of feet would come behind them, so that Varonwe became a dread and said, It is Melko's goblins, the orcs of the hills. Then would they run, falling over stones in the blackness, till they perceived it was but the deceit of the place. Thus did they come, after it seemed a measureless time of fearful groping, to a place where a far light glimmered, and making for this gleam they came to a gate like that by which they had entered, but in no way overgrown. Then they passed into the sunlight, and could for a while see naught, but instantly a great gong sounded, and there was a clash of armor, and behold, they were surrounded by warriors in steel. Then they looked up and could see, and lo, they were at the foot of steep hills, And these hills made a great circle wherein lay a wide plain. And set therein, not rightly at the midmost, but rather nearer to that place where they stood, was a great hill with a level top. And upon that summit rose a city in the new light of the morning. Then Veronwer spake to the guard of the Gondothlin, and his speech they comprehended, for it was the sweet tongue of the gnomes. Note 15. The original reading was, his speech they comprehended, though somewhat different was the tongue of the free Nordally by those days to that of the sad thralls of Melko. The typescript Tuor C has, they comprehended him, for they were Nordally. Then spake Tuor also in the same tongue. End of note. Then spake Tuor also, and questioned where they might be, and who might be the folk in arms who stood about. For he was somewhat in amaze, and wondered much at the goodly fashion of their weapons. Then was said to him by one of that company, we are the guardians of the issue of the way of escape. Rejoice that ye have found it, for behold before you the city of seven names, where all who war with Melko may find hope. Then said Tuor, what be those names? And the chief of the guard made answer, 'Tis said and 'tis sung, Gondovar am I called, and Gondothlimvar, city of stone and city of the dwellers in stone, Gondolin the stone of song, and Gwarestrin am I named, the tower of guard, Garthurion, or the secret place, for I am hidden from the eyes of Melko. But they who love me most greatly call me Loth. For like a flower am I, even Lothengriol, the flower that blooms on the plain. Yet, said he, in our daily speech we speak and we name it mostly Gondolin. Then said Voronwer, bring us thither, for we fain would enter. And Tuor said that his heart desired much to tread the ways of that fair city. Then said the chief of the guard that they themselves must abide here, for there were yet many days of their moon of watch to pass, but that Veronwer and Tuor might pass on to Gondolin, and moreover, that they would need thereto no guide, for lo, it stands fair to see and very clear, and its towers prick the heavens above the hill of watch in the midmost plain. Then Tuor and his companion fared over the plain that was of a marvellous level, broken but here and there by boulders round and smooth which lay amid a sward, or by pools and rocky beds. Many fair pathways lay across that plain, and they came after a day's light march to the foot of the hill of watch, which is in the tongue of the Nordally Amon Gwareth. Then did they begin to ascend the winding stairways which climbed up to the city gate. Nor might anyone reach that city save on foot and espied from the walls. As the western gate was golden in the last sunlight, did they come to the long stairs' head, and many eyes gazed upon them from the battlements and towers. Note 16. The original reading was, it was early morn when they drew near the gates, and many eyes gazed. But when Tuor and Voronwer first saw Gondolin, it was in the new light of the morning, page 158. And it was a day's light march across the plain, hence the change made later to Tuor B. End of note. But Tuor looked upon the walls of stone, and the uplifted towers, upon the glistering pinnacles of the town, and he looked upon the stairs of stone and marble, bordered by slender balustrades, and cooled by the leap of thread-like waterfalls, seeking the plain from the fountains of Amon Gwareth. And he fared as one in some dream of the gods, for he deemed not such things were seen by men in the visions of their sleep, so great was his amaze at the glory of Gondolin. Even so came they to the gates, Tuor in wonder and Voronwer in great joy, that daring much he had both brought Tuor hither in the will of Ulmo, and had himself thrown off the yoke of Melko for ever. Though he hated him no wise less, no longer did he dread that evil one with a binding terror. And of a sooth, that spell which Melko held over the Nordally was one of bottomless dread, so that he seemed ever nigh them, even were they far from the hells of iron, and their hearts quaked, and they fled not even when they could, and to this Melko trusted often. Note 17. Evil One, original reading, Ainu. End of note. Now is there a sally from the gates of Gondolin, and a throng comes about these twain in wonder, rejoicing that yet another of the Nordally has fled hither from Melko, and marveling at the stature and the gaunt limbs of Tuor, his heavy spear barbed with fishbone and his great harp. Rugged was his aspect, and his locks were unkempt, and he was clad in the skins of bears. 'Tis written that in those days the fathers of the fathers of men were of less stature than men now are, and the children of Elfinesse of greater growth. Yet was Tuor taller than any that stood there. Indeed, the Gondothlim were not bent of back, as some of their unhappy kin became, laboring without rest at delving and hammering from Melko, but small were they, and slender, and very lithe. Note 18. This passage from Rugged Was His Aspect is a replacement on a separate slip. The original text was, Tuor was goodly in countenance, but rugged and unkempt of locks, and clad in the skins of bears. Yet his stature was not overgreat among his own folk, but the Gondothlim, though not bent as were no few of their kin, who labored at ceaseless delving and hammering for Melko, were small and slender and lithe. In the original passage, men are declared to be of their nature taller than the elves of Gondolin. See pages 142-220. End of note. They were swift of foot and surpassing fair. Sweet and sad were their mouths, and their eyes had ever a joy within, quivering to tears. For in those times the gnomes were exiles at heart, haunted with a desire for their ancient home that faded not. But fate, an unconquerable eagerness after knowledge, had driven them into far places. And now were they hemmed by Melko, and must make their abiding as fair as they might by labor and by love. How it came ever that among men the Alderley have been confused with the orcs, who are Melko's goblins, I know not, unless it be that certain of the Alderley were twisted to the evil of Melko and mingled among these orcs, for all that race were bred by Melko of the subterranean heats and slime. Their hearts were of granite and their bodies deformed. Foul their faces which smiled not, but their laugh that of the clash of metal, and to nothing were they more fain than to aid in the basest of the purposes of Melko. The greatest hatred was between them and the Noldeli, who named them Glumhoff, or Folk of Dreadful Hate. Behold, the armed guardians of the gate pressed back the thronging folk that gathered about the wanderers, and one among them spake, saying, This is a city of watch and ward, Gondolin on Amon Gwareth. Where all may be free who are of true heart, but none may be free to enter unknown. Tell me then your names. But Voronwe named himself Bronweg of the Gnomes, come hither by the will of Ulmo as guide to this son of men. Note 19. Come hither, escaped from Melko, Tuor sea. End of note. And Tuor said, I am Tuor, son of Peleg, son of Indor, of the house of the Swan, of the sons of the men of the north, who live far hence. And I fare hither by the will of Ulmo of the outer oceans. Then all who listened grew silent, and his deep and rolling voice held them in amaze, for their own voices were fair as the plash of fountains. Then a saying arose among them, Lead them before the king. Then did the throng return within the gates, and the wanderers with them, and Tuor saw they were of iron and of great height and strength. Now the streets of Gondolin were paved with stone and wide, curbed with marble, and fair houses and courts amid gardens of bright flowers were set about the ways, and many towers of great slenderness and beauty, builded of white marble and carved most marvelously, rose to the heaven. Squares there were lit with fountains and the home of birds that sang amid the branches of their aged trees. But of all these, the greatest was that place where stood the king's palace, and the tower thereof was the loftiest in the city. And the fountains that played before the doors shot 20 fathoms and 7 in the air and fell in a singing rain of crystal. Therein did the sun glitter splendidly by day, and the moon most magically shimmered by night. The birds that dwelt there were of the whiteness of snow, and their voices sweeter than a lullaby of music. On either side of the doors of the palace were 2 trees, one that bore blossom of gold and the other of silver. Nor did they ever fade, for they were shoots of old from the glorious trees of Valinor that lit those places before Melko and Gloomweaver withered them. And those trees the Gondothlim named Glingol and Bonsil. Then Turgon, king of Gondolin, robed in white with a belt of gold, and a coronet of garnets was upon his head, stood before his doors and spake from the head of the white stairs that led thereto, "Welcome, O man of the land of shadows! Lo, thy coming was set in our books of wisdom, and it has been written that there would come to pass many great things in the homes of the Gondothlim whence so thou faredst hither." Then spake Tuor, and Ulmo set power in his heart and majesty in his voice. "Behold, O father of the city of stone, I am bidden by him who maketh deep music in the abyss, and who knoweth the mind of elves and men, to say unto thee that the days of release draw nigh. There have come to the ears of Ulmo whispers of your dwelling and your hill of vigilance against the evil of Melko, and he is glad. But his heart is wroth, and the hearts of the Valar are angered who sit in the mountains of Valinor and look upon the world from the peak of Taniquetl, seeing the sorrow of the thraldom of the Noldali and the wanderings of men. For Melko wringeth them in the land of shadows beyond hills of iron. Therefore have I been brought by a secret way to bid you number your hosts and prepare for battle, for the time is ripe." Then spake Turgon, "That will I not do, though it be the words of Ulmo and all the Valar. I will not adventure this my people against the terror of the orcs, nor imperil my city against the fire of Melko." Then spake Tuor, "Nay, if thou dost not now dare greatly, then will the orcs dwell forever, and possess in the end most of the mountains of the earth, and cease not to trouble both elves and men, even though by other means the Valar contrive hereafter to release the Noldali. But if thou trust now to the Valar, though terrible the encounter, then shall the orcs fall, and Melko's power be minished to a little thing." For Turgon said that he was king of Gondolin, and no will should force him against his counsel to imperil the dear labor of long ages gone. But Tuor said, for thus was he bidden by Ulmo, who had feared the reluctance of Turgon, "Then am I bidden to say that men of the Gondothlim repair swiftly and secretly down the river Sirion to the sea, and there build them boats, and go seek back to Valinor, though the paths thereto are forgotten, and the highways faded from the world, and the seas and mountains are about it, yet still dwell there the elves on the hill of Kor, and the gods sit in Valinor, though their mirth is minished for sorrow and fear of Melko, and they hide their land and weave about it inaccessible magic that no evil come to its shores. Yet still might thy messengers win there and turn their hearts that they rise in wrath and smite Melko and destroy the hells of iron that he has wrought beneath the mountains of darkness." Then said Turgon, "Every year at the lifting of winter have messengers repaired swiftly and by stealth down the river that is called Sirion to the coasts of the great sea, and there builded them boats whereto have swans and gulls been harnessed, or the strong wings of the wind, and these have sought back beyond the moon and sun to Valinor. But the paths thereto are forgotten, and the highways faded from the world, and the seas and mountains are about it, and they that sit within in mirth reck little of the dread of Melko or the sorrow of the world, but hide their land and weave about it inaccessible magic, that no tidings of evil come ever to their ears. Nay, enough of my people have for years untold gone out to the wide waters, never to return, but have perished in the deep places, or wander now lost in the shadows that have no paths. And at the coming of next year no more shall fare to the sea, but rather will we trust to ourselves and our city for the warding off of Melko. And thereto have the Valar been of scant help aforetime." Then Tuor's heart was heavy, and Voronwer wept. And Tuor sat by the great fountain of the king, and its splashing recalled the music of the waves. And his soul was troubled by the conscience of Ulmo, and he would return down the waters of Sirion to the sea. But Turgon, who knew that Tuor, mortal as he was, had the favor of the Valar,